Welcome to the Danger Room, a place to prepare for the opponents you are yet to face. We discuss strategy and how to level up your game in Marvel Crisis Protocol. We will have our Xavier Protocol segment, some hot takes discussing something new and shiny, and our main topic of the week. We would like to begin by thanking you, the listener, for giving us your time to listen to our opinions of the game. On the podcast, we have Jacob, Sploosh, and myself, Dizzard.
Welcome back to another week of the Danger Room, and get right into it. And Jacob, what do you have for Xavier Protocols this week?
So we did a couple of weeks ago, we looked at the 3-0 teams, and I thought I'd take a step back and have a look at the 4-1 and above teams in the league now. And honestly, there's not a lot of difference between the 4-1 and the 5-0 teams. It's often it can come down to like one roll on do I flip this meteor, or one attack roll, or one spiked dodge roll. There can be, you know, it's not huge, the difference between being 4-1 and 5-0 right now. So I thought I'd have a look at some of the stats that came out of that. Interesting thing. So looking at what's winning right now is kind of what I'm aiming for. So just in terms of characters, a lot of it is what you'd expect. Slightly interesting that there are, so if there's 36 people across the four different divisions that are 4-1 or 5-0, and of those 36 people, 26 of them are running Okoye and 25 are running Valkyrie and 21 are running Enchantress. So there's no great shakes there. What's kind of interesting though, is that only 14 of them, only 39%, are running Angela. So Angela featured very highly. She was the fourth highest character in terms of popularity across all the builds, but she's below Ghost Spider, she's below Shuri, she's below MODOK in the list of who's actually winning. So I think a lot of people have been very excited by Angela, but it kind of looks like maybe she's a bit more of a finesse piece than we've given her credit for previously. So that was an interesting thing to notice. Another really interesting thing to pull out of this is to look at the spread of affiliations, where they were in terms of the number of lists being played, and which affiliations are making it into those winning rosters. And the really nice thing to see is that the only affiliation which is not represented is Spider Foes, which is kind of predictable. But some of those kind of edge case ones that you're like, well, maybe they won't make it, like Avengers, for example, there's one roster that's running Avengers. So it's nice to see that there is a really good spread there. Asgard tops out with 8 Asgard. But then there's some surprising numbers coming in here. So Asgard's not surprising. We saw they were the most popular faction. They're slightly overrepresented. 9 is a quarter of all the rosters, and they only represented 19% of the rosters that were submitted. So they're, you know, 6% above. If you look at that, you'd expect 19% would be like just about 7 players to make it, and you've got 9. So it looks like Asgard are doing pretty well, but not as well as Web Warriors. So only 15% of the field was Web Warriors, but 22% of the people making those winning rosters. So eight, you'd expect around about 5.5 people, and you're getting 8. So the biggest overperformers compared to the field are Web Warriors. And we talked about that, I think, 2 weeks ago when we looked at how well Web Warriors were doing, particularly in like Central. I think they were doing really well. And that's borne out in this again, that there's a good number of Web Warriors in Central. There's a couple scattered around all over the place, but they're kind of flying a little bit under the radar, I think, in terms of the power level.
Yeah, West was 2 undefeateds back when I was doing the 3-0s. But yeah, and West, Web Warriors took Sooner out pretty hard of Sooner's like completely out of contention now for making the bracket. Well, maybe under 4-2 or something, but I think that's unlikely at this point for him.
And Esmond as well, last year's champion, is 3-2 currently, so he's...
And Web Warriors beat him, right?
Yeah, I believe so.
Wait, did they beat him twice? Because, he lost to the Web Warrior guy that I played against, Graham, and then he lost to Merzane, who I know was playing Loki. No, Merzane was playing Asgard, but he slants Web Warriors too, I believe. But anyway, so but that's still like strong. That's like high level games at the end of the event. and their WebWare is taking down two extremely strong players.
So a lot of this is kind of within the kind of normal range. So the next highest variance on the positive overachieving side is X-Men. You'd expect 3.6 X-Men players and you've got 5. So I feel like that's kind of fine, and it's not really that worthy of comment. And then there's a whole load which are between sort of one player above or one player below where you'd expect, and that's kind of natural variance. But then there's 4 that stand out as being 2 players out to the negative. So you'd expect Cabal. They were 9% of the field, so you'd expect at least, you know, typically three players, and only one Cabal list has made the this sort of 4-1 or better cut where we're looking at the minute. Avengers, maybe that's not surprising. You'd expect they were 10%, so you'd expect 3.6 players, and you've got 1. But then the next 2, I think, are kind of big surprises, and they're the biggest variance from what you'd expect. And that's A-Force, who were 19% after the roster change. And so you'd expect around about 6.8 players, and you've only got 4. But the biggest variance is Defenders, where they were 13%, but there's only one Defenders player who's made the 4-1 or better. And so that's out by, you'd expect 4.7. So nearly 5 players, and you've only got 1. And I think that's really interesting. I am that one Defenders player that's 4-1 or better. And I talk a bit to some of the other people who are playing a similar roster and who were there or thereabouts, like Quote My Name and Kevin Stewart, I think, are the two that I've been speaking to the most, who have been, I think they might both be 3-2 now instead of 4-1. And they're playing a very similar roster. And it's interesting to see the difference between 3-2 and 4-1 is not massive. It can be, again, it can just be a dice roll. So it's not that I think Defenders is a bad faction, but I think maybe kind of the preparation work, particularly if you're playing a more play-focused list, let's put it that way, where you're doing particular turn one plays or round one plays, and you're looking to execute a certain plan, you need a lot of practice in that plan. You also need to do a lot of prep work into the map and, you know, where's a good spot for you to deploy, where's a bad spot for you to deploy, where does stuff work, where does stuff not work with the plan you've got in mind. And I'm not saying these players didn't do that prep work, but maybe it's really interesting for me. We had, 7 out of 16 players in Season 3 went into the postseason with Defenders as part of their roster. And now they've just really fallen away this season. So just worthy of notice.
Yeah, it's shocking to me. I expected Defenders to be high up there due to the shenanigans of the portal.
Well, I wonder if people are kind of leaning too heavily on the shenanigans of the portal, because Defenders has a really good roster, just the characters it's got in it are some really strong characters, and the leadership is great and Strange. If you're playing in those kind of central CE shape scenarios, Strange has got a great suite of powers that just work really well on his whole team. And maybe people are diving too deep in the jank tank. Maybe I'm guilty of this as well. But maybe we need to be playing a more vanilla Defenders and not a nonsense Defenders.
Well, you mean you playing Hulk, and I mean you're the Hulk guy winning, so I guess I shouldn't criticize too much. But I think the traditional like MODOK blow people up Defenders was kind of like where we were at the end of Season 3, and I agree. It's tricky. I've watched some Defenders games, and I've seen some of the Defenders setups, and like wasn't super pleased with their turn ones or even turn zeros. So like, I think, like you said, like a little misstep here, a little misstep there, a miscalculation on how much power you even have. You know, like if Strange has no power after portaling turn one, and then like, you know, you gotta like pick up some hammers and interact with like meteors, it can be quite a tax on your team. Especially if you're going through the portal and nothing's available to shoot at because the opponent's like playing really cagey. You got like this really awkward like do nothing turn where you're like low on power, so it's hard to capitalize. I don't know. I noticed some awkwardness with it. And I don't know if that was, like you said, lack of prep.
And maybe it's because their opponents are really well prepped and they've thought a lot about this matchup. So when they see they're playing Defenders, they're like, right, okay, I really need to bring my A game. I need to figure out what they're going to do and I need to have a plan. And maybe good players do that and have plans. And maybe it's a feature of the format that you've got, you know, you get the pairings on Sunday and you maybe you're playing your game on Wednesday and you've got 4 days to think about it and strategize and plan, where in a real life tournament, you've got 5 minutes. You know, you get, here's your pairing, go to the table, go and play the game. And maybe defenders will do, this kind of janky defenders list will do better in a real life tournament compared to an online tournament.
Yeah, well, that's a whole nother thing too, because I going to real life tournaments for other games, I find the real life tournaments generally are easier than online tournaments, because not just of what you said, but you know, you're dealing with a lot bigger community and, you know, got a lot of strong players out there, and yeah. You know, a real life tournament has a bit more casual going on, so
I think we got plenty casual in this league, so I don't think that's maybe.
I'm not saying there's no, it's just more, not that there is none. Yeah. Now, I think it's, the league is full of casual. I've met a lot of relatively new players this season, and that's exciting. It's really healthy for any game when you keep running into new people and new blood. That's really good for the game. But the bottom line is, when you're at a real life tournament, you know, you might have like a casual guy, and that's not a negative. I'm not insulting anyone by saying casual. I mean, that's not like you're bad at the game. It just, you don't think of it the way other people do. But that guy may have a friend and he doesn't want to go alone. And his friend might be the guy he plays against a lot. So the friend is even less interested in brainstorming the best team. You know, he's just playing maybe a little more casually. So the point is, I just, that's been my finding. So I see what you're saying. And I definitely feel like I've played X-Men a lot. And even during this league, I've learned a ton. And it would strengthen me for a real life event, obviously, and experience would, you know, but you have to learn to make on the fly decisions, and playing in the online event, I've been able to put a little bit more time into thinking, but I know that if I was to go to like a real life event, having the reps and the experience of having this sort of mock event would make me faster and able to make those snap decisions. So I don't think you also are eliminating the ability to kind of meta your opponent. You just have to be able to do it quicker than you would online, you know?
So maybe people would be interested in just a quick rundown of these 36 players, which affiliations are the most highly featured. Asgard, 9 lists running some kind of Asgard in them. And then this was, like I say, the surprise we've kind of already mentioned. Web Warriors are next at 8. Wakanda and Brotherhood at 6, X-Men at 5, Black Order are worth mentioning, because they're a bit above where you'd expect them to be. There's 4 Black Order lists, so people, I don't know, they've been inspired by Morgan and his near victory in Season 3, but Black Order are a serious force, and you shouldn't be ignoring them. A-Force down at 4, like same with Black Order. I'm not sure many people would have predicted that. Guardians and Criminal Syndicate, both with 3. I think, again, who would have predicted that Guardians have as many winning rosters as Criminal Syndicate? I think if you ask most people, they'll say that Criminal Syndicate are significantly above the curve compared to Guardians. So interesting how that's shaking out. And then 1 each for unaffiliated Defenders, Cabal, and Avengers, and 0 for Spider Foes.
So there's 5 people playing X-Men, 4 not including me?
Yeah. Well, 4.
Where the heck are these people? So they must have like been kind of the people sort of submarining in, because my initial searching, I did not find these people. So I don't know. Also, people may have changed their rosters.
That's true. Right? So I'm looking at rosters from week 4 onwards. So then maybe they were doing something different before, but there's 3 in Central, 3 X-Men in Central, and 2 in Oceania.
Huh. I'll have to look at that. I don't know where they came from, because I wasn't seeing them earlier.
Well, then I'll tell you.
Yeah. I'll check the stats later, I guess.
Yeah.
See what they're up to.
So I think you're the only one who's solo X-Men. Yeah, you're the only one who's solo X-Men. All the others are like, there's 1 Brotherhood X-Men, there's 1 Wakanda X-Men, there's 1 X-Men Wakanda and Avengers X-Men. So I didn't dig down into what they actually played. I could have done, I suppose, and see what's actually being played. But there are 4 people who've got X-Men as a viable team in their roster who are making 4-1 or better. Sorry, 5.
So I want to go back to like one of the first things that you pointed out, and that was the whole Angela being not taken as much as expected.
Well, she's taken a lot, but just she doesn't appear in the winning rosters as much as you might expect.
So try to think of like, how would you classify Angela as a character in this game? Would you classify her as like a beater or a utility or objective getter? Like, what would you classify her as?
I think any of the five threat characters don't fall neatly into one slot. They all have, to justify their five threat costs, they all have elements of different things. Mm-hmm. And I'd say Angela's two main strengths are, objective play. So she's got some really interesting things that she can do that no other character can do unassisted. Mm-hmm. So turn one on cubes, picking up two cubes, the center one and a back one, for example. That's something that nobody else can do without like tactics cards coming into play. Mm-hmm. So having interesting scenario plays with her, and then her value as a beater. Yeah, so she can take out multiple small characters is where she really excels. So she can be triggering Cosmic Assassin as often as she can. Doesn't have a great way to spend her power, typically. She often has a surplus of power that she doesn't know what to do with. So often good tactics cards on her. You know, a Doomed Prophecy Angela, for example, is something really scary.
So, like, where my head's at with this is, like, thinking, especially because, like, right when you said it, you had mentioned, like, Ghost Spider and, like, another character. And it's made me thinking, like, maybe these five and one or whatever, the people that are four and ones and the people mm-hmm. that are going to make the cut, essentially, maybe they're valuing cheaper utility over the five threat.
Multi-rounder.
So it kind of brings up the thought of, like, is utility worth more than five threat?
Well, of the top eight, there's, you know, five of them are three or two costs. So you've got Okoye, Valkyrie, Ghost Spider, Shuri, and Toad in the top eight. Mm-hmm. Top ten, you then get Black Panther and Thor. And the ones who I didn't mention there were Enchantress, MODOK, and Angela. So those are the... But Enchantress, seeing more and more play, and quite rightly so, she's absolutely fantastic.
So it almost, like, with those names right there, it almost strictly seems like you got your bang for your bucks and your utility, and then you have your specialty characters and your high threat, and then you have, like, your leaders.
Yeah, but again, because you've got such a spread of different affiliations, the leaders aren't polling very highly. What's polling highly is the bang for the buck and the, you know, just the good solid goes in any roster characters.
Yeah, it was just a thought that I had when you were talking about it was is utility being valued more than characters like Angela that are not just pure utility, I guess?
I guess to an extent. And I think it comes down to the value proposition, doesn't it? And the trouble is a value proposition is so much harder on a five threat character than it is on a two or a three threat character for them to justify their value. And the issue with Angela in particular is she doesn't have any dice mitigation built in. Mm-hmm. So if she doesn't hit that the hit symbol on her range four attack, so she doesn't get the pursuit trigger. if she, feels really bad. Now I will just do that same attack again, and that's my turn. I just did 2 5 dice range four attacks. Well, that feels a bit like a four threat or maybe even a three threat character's job. And if you don't get that, then she feels a bit underwhelming and she doesn't have any dice mitigation built in on offense. Not being able to reroll against her is kind of dice mitigation, I guess, but then sometimes you just blank out on Angela and she just evaporates.
Yeah, that's very true.
Basically, Angela's value is literally the domination of extracts, and that mm-hmm. is priority dependent. So you're already at a 50% chance.
Sure, but you can just not take her if you don't have priority. She's one of your 10 in your
roster. Right, but that's the problem. And then even if you do take her, you probably should correctly be playing passively with her, which is a little awkward also because she's also 5 threat. So if you charge in with that extract with Angela, you're running the risk of giving up your big advantage that you're playing with. And then... All that being said, even if you're playing passively, you're still running a dice game where, like you said, if you don't roll the value you're looking for, if you're playing beast, you're kind of okay with like, fine, he doesn't ambush, I'll just sit on this point, you know. Where if you're playing Angela and you get the bad roll, that's just so much more impactful to your team. And it's just variance on top of variance on top of more variance, and it makes her arguably unreliable at times. It's probably unfair to generalize. I don't think Angela's like a bad character, and I don't fault anyone for playing her. And I know we've had previous discussions about running like, say, three characters, and she fits into that role because she'll let you keep up with the VPs while also being a part of that functionality of being a small team. I mean, her role exists in this game, and it also could be anecdotal, all of this, because maybe she just requires more skill to use because you're running these more difficult teams, you know. And I'm pretty sure from here that some people have been abandoning the smaller rosters lately, and I don't know why. That might be for a future interview or questioning. I don't know, but and we'll have to see the success in the end of things, you know, and how. You know, there's been a lot of talk about Thanos and all that stuff, and is it panning out, you know?
Well, quick check in there. 5 out of the 36 rosters are running Thanos, including one in Cabal. So the Cabal roster is a Cabal-Thanos roster, which is interesting.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. So, you know, and just because something's not popular doesn't make it bad either, you know? So
yeah, that's true. Like Guardians for a long time weren't popular, but I think... anyone who says Guardians are bad now is just wrong. I think seeing how Suna did in season 3 and seeing these three players now in season 4, if you think Guardians are bad, you need to check that and look at them again.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that Suna, I know, had a little bit of fear that Criminal Syndicate was just like too good against the Guardians. But if you don't run into Syndicate, it's just like one of those things. If you don't see your bad matchups, then you're fine. You know? So anyway.
All right. So moving on, we're going to give a shout out to the guys that sponsor the Across the Bifrost Nexus, and that includes us. That's going to be in the UK. It's Blackgate Games. You can find them. I'll put the link to their website in the show notes. And we have Discount Games Inc. And that link will be in the show notes as well. There is currently a team tournament being worked together. Jacob, would you like to talk about that real quick?
Yeah, so this is something that I'm very excited about. We talked briefly about team tournaments in a previous cast, but I'm very lucky to have some great teammates. I'm working with Sploosh and Suna on Zero Danger is our team name for the team tournament that's happening on TTS next weekend. And it's worth pointing out, you know, we've done a couple of sort of one-day event teams tournaments, just like individual tournaments recently on TTS, and they've been getting like somewhere between 14 and 18 players, and we've got two pools, sort of one a North American time zone and one a European time zone, and there are 10 teams signed up to each, so that's 30 players in both of those, which is significantly more than those those individual tournaments that I just mentioned. So, you know, team tournaments are drawing players, and they are a real thing. And I can't wait to see how this goes. I'm really looking forward to it, and I'm hoping we're going to talk about it a bit more detail on another cast. But if you're not already aware of those team tournaments, go back and have a look at our previous cast on it. Check out, there was a really good cast, the taco truck. What are they called? Alfredo's taco truck. Is that right?
Yep.
Yeah, they did a great one on their experience with team tournaments. Go and check that out if you haven't already. I'm super hyped to play with a couple of great guys and get some good games in. I'm really looking forward to it.
I want to give a shout out to the name Three Guys No Podcast.
Yeah, particularly because he's surrounded by, like, he's got us and he's got ATB and he's got the taco truck guys. Just like, he's surrounded by a whole load of people who are from podcasts, and they picked that name before they knew they were surrounded by a whole load of podcasts, so it's double props for that.
Yeah, they're literally surrounded. It's beautiful.
So this week's hot takes, we're going to dive into Lockjaw. Sploosh, you want to go ahead and head us off with this one?
Oh my gosh. where do I even begin with Lockjaw? This might be like becoming the most heated, sort of maybe over-talked about character at this point. But yeah, wow. Lockjaw is a mouthful. First of all, I'll just say I'm sure the Lockjaw's existence is to make Inhumans playable. You know, having a 5-thread expensive Black Bolt, I feel like Lockjaw, we kind of hinted too, even when we didn't know what Lockjaw did, that we're like, I feel like Black Bolt will exist because of Lockjaw, and I think that's going to end up proving true. I guess I'll just start with like the super basic concepts of Lockjaw that is critical to the character. I think a lot of people probably are very familiar at this point about what he does. He only has the one attack. He's very Wong-esque with the one range two physical. But I think his like kind of deal breaker here is two things. One is who's a good boy, where he has to activate next to a teammate. It has to be range two, which is pretty restrictive. It sounds not a big deal, but that is a big deal. Especially if you're trying to play like on map D, even, I don't know, what's the other one? I think it's C. No, not C. That's the,
Formula like one?
The bomb trap one, right? There's yeah, D, D and then
Mute C? Madman.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's B. Yeah.
Yeah. Madman. Like, so even on Madman, maybe he's with like one other person, but how you activate him can be controlled by your opponent because maybe they push Lockjaw or they push his teammate. And then the reason that's super restrictive is it's such a huge difference. Like Lockjaw gets one power per turn, but when he activates next to a teammate, he gets three extra power for four power, right? So I guess a 75% increase or would it be 300%? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, whatever. That's a high number. Yeah. So yeah, you're going to want to do that. And I'm going to say that I think Lockjaw is extremely good. I'm not sure if he breaks the game I think this is going to be a wait and see. I'm going to be a little bit of a coward here and just say he's going to be good and not broken. But I'm open to the idea that he could be comboed out eventually in this game to be annoying and broken. But the reason all that I say that is because who's a good boy sounds so good on paper. And I think on turn one, it is just good, period. Because a lot of times on turn one, you're focused on kind of getting some kind of extract advantage or punishing extracts. For example, maybe you don't get the cube because you activated Lockjaw first, but you have put like some super scary, horrifying thing in contention with the character that took a cube. And then maybe your opponent's too scared to grab the cube, so they kind of just let you grab it the next turn. Like, so it's kind of like this like nuclear deterrent. So that's like, I'd say level one with Lockjaw is like just, you know, the tempo, that's a good word here. So I'd say the tempo is wacky with Lockjaw because to get the full benefit of him, you're encouraged to like activate him early, but you're giving up tempo because a character you maybe normally would activate first is not activating, you know, on schedule. It's giving your opponent like an activation to like react to what you're doing. And then if you choose to not use Lockjaw, you're giving your opponent the opportunity to kind of tempo you out and make it really awkward for you and potentially not even allow a teleport because you moved something away from Lockjaw or a Lockjaw away from a character. So that gets kind of wild. So it's this little battle of tempo. It is important to remember, and I swear I just keep forgetting, but his teleports do cost an action. So if he's just doing like teleport move, and maybe he's getting you some kind of secure, so it's not like a complete wash, but that's basically his entire turn. It's a three threat character that literally just moves someone and then moves himself and he's done. Or potentially not even that. Like maybe he just moves someone and then stays where he is, you know? So that's three threat, just not doing anything. And you consider like activations, like, you know, I don't know. I think of this guy Jacob, who plays Valkyrie with three threat and murders an entire team in one activation. I mean, you know, I mean, we all can't, you know, if people have never heard this story, I mean, this guy activates Valkyrie, like kills like a, what did you do? Angela killed up based on
a single attack. 30, yeah, like Hulk. 13 damage to She-Hulk to KO her. That was three attacks and a throw and one final damage to Thor. So it KO'd Angela, Thor, and She-Hulk in one Valkyrie activation in my league game this week. I am so sorry to my opponent, Dave. He was winning that game, hands down, until that happened.
Yeah, like, I mean, I'm kind of just teasing here, but like, hey, that's a thing that happened. Like, I'm not saying it's, I find it very unlikely Lockjaw does the same thing to any in a game. And so you may be playing Lockjaw. You may be playing Lockjaw unaffiliated and you're not playing Valkyrie, which can murder an entire team in one activation. I mean, you know, maybe Lockjaw just bites someone twice and throws something. I mean, maybe you kill three characters, but it's probably pretty unlikely. I mean, there is a cost, you know, like moving someone around. So I don't know. I'll leave it off to you guys. I'm sure I know I missed a million things and there are some combos I'd like to mention at the end of this, but I don't want to get sucked into that this minute. But I just he's a really wacky tempo piece. He is a sacrifice. He does hit above his weight class when you allow it, like when you do stand next to this guy. And I will say, even though I'm mentioning the wide extracts, it seems to me like based on the card that Bitter Rivals, which I'm sure we'll talk about later in another podcast. But it seems to me like you play Gamma with Inhumans and you create this mosh pit of death. And I think Lockjaw is very solid in that situation. So I don't know. What do you got, Jacob?
So I think I agree with you. And I don't feel that it's particularly safe because I think there's a lot of people saying Lockjaw is the best thing out there. And he's such a good use of three threat. And he's like S tier and he's broken. I don't think he is. I think there are certain teams that are going to maximize him and that he's going to work really well in. And maybe that's the case, that he's got like a few teams where he really shines. And, you know, it's possible that Inhumans is one of those. But I think, you know, like Criminal Syndicate seems good, or potentially any team where you've got a big high threat beta that you want to move forward. So like Magneto is a great example. If you want to move Magneto forwards so that he can then start doing Magneto things in the middle of the board, great. Or Corvus with the Reality Gem, or potentially even like 9-point Thanos, you know, throwing 9-threat Thanos up the board round one. Seems good, yeah? But what's he doing for the rest of the game? You've got really strong turn one options with him. And turn one is a big thing right now. But I'm not convinced that his value is spread evenly throughout the rounds. So, again, my take is he's good. And I can see lots of places where I want to play him. But you're right, when people learn to play against him, particularly mitigating who's a good boy, I think that's going to be a key part of playing against him. So pushes, throws to get people away. There's some interesting activation order issues, and I think you're going to be tempted, and this is something I think is going to evolve, is you're going to be tempted to play Lockjaw with Follow Me, particularly if you've got one of those beta characters I just mentioned. Because round two, Lockjaw can activate first. He got 4 power in the first round. Let's say he's activating first, you're getting 4 power in the second round. He's got enough power to play Follow Me as well as to teleport someone. So he can teleport someone and play Follow Me. So he can teleport Corvus Glaive with a Reality Gem up. He can teleport Magneto up. And then they can activate straight away without any ability for your opponent to respond to it. So I think there's some play there. But then you're committing a 3-threat character and a tactics card. And maybe that's maximizing your high-threat character. But in a way, you're kind of making your 5-threat Reality Corvus into an 8-threat plus a tactics card. And for that kind of investment, you'd want them to be doing a lot. So I'm not sure that that's an unrealistic return on the threat that you're investing in it. Whereas I think after that round, where Reality Corvus has been moved further away from Lockjaw, for example, so that he can't teleport him because he's not within 3 of him, then the value of Lockjaw is going down significantly and you're getting much less return on your eighth threat and your tactics card is gone, so you're not getting that. Although maybe that's helped you steal priority or retain priority, so maybe that's done its job. But yeah, I think that kind of is a really great example of what I'm trying to say. There are ways of using him which are really strong. And the other thing to touch on, and this is something that Dave Utility Cookie mentioned in our Discord chat, join our Discord if you want more great insights from people like Dave, is, you know, the one mode that Lockjaw plays in is the throw something forward at you mode, throw a big beater at you. The other mode he plays in is the counter control mode, which is really interesting to see coming into the game. Against someone like Wakanda, where Shuri and Black Panther are going around and pushing you off points and Valkyrie's throwing you off points and all that kind of stuff they do, Lockjaw comes in at the end of a round and goes, you go back on the point, you go back on the point. So it's that counter control to fight them against the secure game. And I haven't seen how it plays against like a Wakanda wave style list, but I can see in my head that's pretty good. That you're going, well, do you know what? All of that effort you've put into moving my people around, we're just gonna undo that. So I can see there are lists where, you know, Wakanda doesn't want to see Lockjaw. That checks out for me.
Yeah, I mean, it's even twofold with Criminal Syndicate, right? Because it's probably a really big play early on in the game as well. And you can even keep your characters safer and then end of like activation move that character onto the point. So then they're like super healthy and unattacked and potentially costing your opponent actions in their turns because your character's not in range. So like, what are you going to do? You just like double move your character, do nothing. And then, you know, Lockjaw activates, puts the character on the point, scores you VPs, completely wasted all the time of the characters contesting. And so, you know, it's like sort of a like invisible debuff in a way. It gives you a lot of anti-control tech. So I think that's actually Criminal Syndicate's biggest weakness, is getting moved around. So kind of undoing all that is huge.
I think one of his strongest games is going to be Gamma.
For sure.
I think you could essentially get somebody onto the back point round one. And if you're in Syndicate, that could be a huge point swing. I don't know. That's like my mind goes.
People to that, yeah. So they're not respecting like, that threat.
Yeah. So it's like, but if
I,
you
I
don't
feel like that's, I don't know. I feel like that's something that you're gonna fall into that trap once and then go, okay, they've got Lockjaw. I need to put two people on my back point.
Yeah.
And you go, well, the counterplay to this is not hard. I just need to learn to do that. I also think, you know, some of those.
Also,
some of
the, but,
no, you go.
Well, at that point, you're really slowing down the Gamma play as well as the Lockjaw player. If the person's going to counter it that way, then you're having more threat that you could push forward onto the middle point. So if they're going to defend their back point that much, again, let's just keep with the Syndicate example, then it gives you the higher possibility of taking the middle point if they're going to be defending the back point that much.
I mean, maybe, but, you know, Syndicate is already really good on Gamma. I mean, does magnifying a strength really add much? I don't feel like there's a huge value add there. And I think that maybe you're going to get a similar effect from someone like Valkyrie, who's able to throw people as opposed to just terrain.
Yeah.
Well, I want to actually mention some combos. Valkyrie is actually a fun example. So if you... like, let's say on Gamma, and you're playing Criminal Syndicate, and so you can move Valkyrie up the middle, like most of the range three, which I admit puts her a little bit in danger. But then Valkyrie can double move throw on her activation and contest the back, which is kind of nutty considering she's just like moves medium. And that would mean like three characters would have to stay in the back for Criminal Syndicate. And I actually think that holds more weight for D maps because people are much less likely to have a whole team sitting on their back middle, you know? So even if you weren't playing Criminal Syndicate, you could do that trick, you know? Because usually the center of the...
That's nice, round one.
Yeah, center of D is going to be usually a wasteland, because people are generally going to go those wide angles, and then they're busy with extracts. So that's a cute one.
I don't know how I feel about that, because then you've got, what, Lockjaw sitting on a back point with no
one. Yeah, Lockjaw back, your back, Valkyrie on their back. I mean, and then you're picking one of the left or right. It seems strong to me.
Yeah. I mean, maybe, but it feels like Lockjaw is not going to do well in the mid to late game in that scenario. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't know. I would kind of go, okay, yeah, you get a nice early play. You've gone 3-1 up on secures. Sorry, yeah, you're on secures. But I'm going to win the long game on that side, because I mean, Valkyrie's a great character, don't get me wrong, but she's not super durable. And Lockjaw's, you know, nice with the six. He's six on both sides, isn't he?
Yeah, he's and, 6-5.
Yeah, he's a tanky boy.
He's pretty tanky, but even then, it's not.
I mean, unofficial 4-4-4 though, with 6 health each side.
Four
I mean,
minus,
he's
four minus, yeah.
And we've talked extensively about how 6 health matters. Oh, he's 5 on the back.
Yeah,
because he's 5 on the back.
Okay, so he's literally Valkyrie,
but 4-4-4.
With a little bit better dice though on defense. But I don't know, man. I'd have to do. You know, we had a whole thing about doing the math, and maybe stealing that one VP for one turn would be enough to play defensive for the rest of the game. You know.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot to it. Like, there's nothing saying Valkyrie even has to stay. Like, you could, like, I don't know, early activate Valkyrie, throw that character again at the beginning of your turn, just run away. I mean, I don't know. Just be obnoxious. Maybe set up to do it again on the third turn. You know, I mean, just be obnoxious. you know, you can win games by just playing like that. I've watched people play Wakanda versus Wakanda in Australia, and they'll just do like Valkyrie, like move, throw your character, like, or no, I think they were doing Vision. It was like move, throw your character, move back, score. Like, they get 2 power because they're playing the serums. Is it
Infinity Gauntlet?
Yeah, I guess it is serums. Yeah, and so it was like literally like 4 turns in a row. The guy would just like move, throw, move, and what he was doing is making it so his opponent could only really like. Either they had to choose to like move, maybe make like one attack, or just like score. And it was, I just like laughing, but I'm like, I guess that makes sense. I mean, you're just playing to score VPs and hold what you got, you know? Mm. Anyway, that one's pretty cute. So normally a long mover just barely can't reach like the back of a D. Obviously with Lockjaw, you could do it, and with a lot of give. So someone couldn't even like try to block you. MODOK getting moved the full 3 puts MODOK in contention for middle points, and it puts you at range 2. So if you move Black Dwarf to the center and if somebody was contesting, then that means by default that you have a range 2 attack with Dwarf. So you move Dwarf up, somebody comes up to grab or contest something, you're getting range 2 attacks with Dwarf. So that's pretty nice.
I mean, so not in the same team as MODOK.
Running
this weird team with like MODOK.
No, I mean, I'm just saying like, this because. Well, so I'm saying this because, I mean, you could make that work, but my point is that, like, obviously MODOK has a range 4 attack, and moving him up into contest range of like, let's say Gamma or grabbing a cube or something, that's pretty cool. But the reason I'm mentioning the range 2, yeah, I mentioned the range 2 because maybe someone goes and grabs a hammer and they're just standing there, and then you just move Dwarf up, he gets 2 swings with 6 dice.
Oh, okay, so he plays against it. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So I mean, that's something to know. Like, it's just something to remember. I actually think of it like this. If they're large base, they get a range 2 attack center. If they're a medium or small base, they have a range 3 attack. That's pretty cool because you have characters like Medusa who came out with the range 3. Yeah, so you can move Medusa up. And then, yeah, Venom, another good example. So that's a good thing to remember. Just a cheat sheet for your brain of like, hey, I'm playing against Lockjaw. What can he do? Well, I know a large base has a range 2 attack on me, and I know the medium and small are going to get their range 3 double attack on me. which, you know, can be pretty scary.
Mm.
Significant for map D and significant for extracts where you have to go middle. That's kind of the extent. I mean, I like, again, like, I like that you could grab like a cube and then just kind of chill. And then, oh yeah, so locked, if you grab like a cube and Lockjaw's near the cube, you can then have Lockjaw late activate, get the power boost from the range 2, and then move you on to a map D objective. So basically you can play like a passive turn 1 with your starting character and then have kind of Lockjaw clean it up, which I don't hate that as a strategy as well. Or, yeah, I think that's a fun little tech just to have that as in your, and again, if you're playing Criminal Syndicate, it's even better.
Yeah.
I think just in general, the big winners are going to be like Kingpin, Magneto, Dwarf, Crossbones, of course, good old Crossbones, and then the obvious like MODOK and that kind of stuff.
And then anyone playing against Wakanda or Web Warriors.
Yeah, and Corvus is kind of awkward, right? Because notice I mentioned the medium base only gets the range 3. Corvus wants a range 2. He's just not big enough. So,
yeah.
That's about it.
I am looking at, having said, I think he's only good, not great. I am looking at bringing him into my Defenders roster. I'm playing Hela in there at the minute, and the tech there is Hela gets 2 power a round and has a 50 mil base. And that means that round 1, she can jump through a portal for a power, and if you place your portal correctly, she can grab an evacuee without having to move, and then she can move back twice. And what's kind of cute about Lockjaw, he's going to get 4 power, not 2, so he's got extra power. Great. And he's got the same large base, so he can still grab that civilian. Yes, he's not moving back as far, but he's still moving short plus a 50 more base twice. Seems pretty good. And then he gives you options. You've spent 2 power, 1 to jump through the portal, 1 to grab a civilian. If he can get that 4 power again the next round, then he can potentially evacuate that civilian round 2. You won't always want to do that, but I feel like it's going to kind of be nice to have that option. And so Lockjaw is competing in that spot against Hela in my roster in particular. So there's another little combo spot there.
I guess worth mentioning, Hulk fits in the large base range 2 situation as well.
Yeah, it's nice that you mention him. It's always good to mention Hulk. I don't feel that playing aggressively with Hulk is the way to maximize him. It's been my experience.
It could be awkward.
When you do that, he feels lackluster and often underperforms and gets taken out of the game one way or another, either by control or by attrition, without too much impact on the game. So it's just been my experience with him.
Yeah, it could be like a psychological thing where somebody wants to like grab a cube in the middle and you could just have Hulk threaten to go up there and get him. And then also, since Hulk's just getting up there, I imagine he can throw the person, right? Hulk's throws, is it 2 power?
Yep.
To do that? So you could just like put Hulk next to that character and just have Hulk throw the character into your team. It's a lot of psychological warfare.
Yeah, even better if there's a size 4 central, because throwing a size 4 in really hurts. And if it's only a 1 power character, they're not going to have the power to brace.
Mm. Yep. So anyway, I like what you said about Follow Me, though. I hadn't considered that. That might be a tech I need to think about.
I think there's cute play there. I don't know whether it's good enough to be consistent to make rosters, but it crossed me and I just thought, yeah, that feels like that could be good.
Yeah, I mean, it also potentially could give you priority for the next turn, and that's always good.
That could be huge, depending on what your team's trying to achieve. But I thought that was fun to think about.
Often in this game, first of all, most games only last like roughly 4 turns or so. So you're not obviously going to do Follow Me turn 1. So I mean, the 3 biggest turns of the game, like you could decide the entire game by an epic Follow Me play. So I do think that is absolutely something to think about.
Mm. And especially if you're going down that advance a beta strategy. So otherwise your beta gets blocked or stunned or staggered or... you know, something happens to them in that activation that your opponent gets in between teleporting them up and them actually going.
What about playing Lockjaw in, what is it, in Black Order, and then doing the follow me into husband-wife combo? So even though you're murdering like half their team, you still have priority. Like, I'll see you next turn.
I think Black Order is another place that Lockjaw potentially fits. They don't have high competition at that three threat. I mean, even some Black Order players are like, oh, do I really want Proxima now? They're starting to sort of question that and thinking about, well, maybe I can just go Thanos, Corvus, and like one other character and play just three wide. So, and I think maybe Lockjaw's not an awful backfield, send my killer characters further up. I don't kind of hate that. I think that can play decently. So I think Black Order is not a bad spot for him.
Having played a lot of Corvus lately, like double activating is very, 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 very powerful. So yeah, maybe Proxima can feel lackluster at times, but just forcing that two activations to get priority the next turn, that like that alone can like win you a game. So yeah, I didn't follow me, which does it again. I mean, oh my gosh. I mean, you could theoretically have two activations in a turn. Your opponent's playing like five characters. I mean, you kill three of them and you still have priority. like, you know? Like,
yep. And again, sort of a wide squishy team, like sort of Wakanda or Guardians or something like that, then yeah, that can be brutal.
Yeah, and then you just kind of, maybe not perfectly, but you kill like two the next turn. I mean, that's like the all according to plan kind of shenanigans that,
well, why not play
feels,
that?
It's going to feel brutal.
Yeah, play that card as well. So you got one, you got a follow me turn, and then you've got an all according to plan turn. I can see that being very painful. You're not going to have priority after that.
Yeah, we'll all be dead.
How do you guys think Lockjaw plays into Hired Muscle?
Anything that helps turn one is just jumping in the pile.
Like, well, I mean, more so a counter to Hired Muscle, less than helping it.
Well, I think it does both, because clearly Hired Muscle, the whole thing there is you're further away from the enemy, so they're getting fewer attacks around one, and then you run away. And putting them even further back, you know, a lot of people really like it in Asgard for the ability to Rainbow Bridge, which is a range three place, and guess who else has a range three place? So I can see it kind of enabling further ridiculousness. And the fact that Lockjaw can move up and grab like the close evacuee whilst also teleporting. I haven't checked the trigonometry on this, but I think it feels like he can go and grab the close evacuee whilst teleporting the person who grabbed the far evacuee and then generate power again next round. Yeah. So
I'll double check it, but I'm almost positive.
That feels like a strong, I'm playing the Hired Muscle play. But again, you know, a really good thing to do against that is to get a beta character up to take down a character, or to take like your Enchantress or your Miles character who can make them either lose or drop those citizen tokens. So getting those further up the field can be a good counterplay. It feels like you're investing an awful lot into this one particular route of play, and maybe that's going to be a staple of the competitive scene for a while. We'll see. But I don't like that kind of hyper specialization. Speaking as someone who plays a hyper specialized force, when it goes wrong, you don't have anything to fall back on.
Well, I was just thinking, like, he seems like a general, like, a decent piece that helps in different places. I was just thinking, like, if someone's playing Hired Muscle against me and I have Lockjaw, I think Lockjaw kind of helps even out the table of the Hired Muscle, just because he's able to get you up the board to counteract the movements of the tokens.
Yeah, maybe, but it kind of feels like, you know, playing Hired Muscle against Hired Muscle in the, do I have to take this in my roster, just because if I don't take this in my roster, I'm going to lose to this strategy.
Yeah.
And this is, are you then taking Lockjaw not because you like the way he synergizes with your team, but you're taking him because you're it's your counterplay to this one specific strategy, which you might not even see.
Yeah. But I think it's a better counter than Hired Muscle, just because Lockjaw is more useful than just Hired Muscle.
I think I agree. I think Hired Muscle, to count Hired Muscle, isn't super useful. I think you need more than that. But you take my point. It's the line of thinking. It's the mental attitude of going, this is my counter to this, and so I have to take it, because if I see it, then I need to have a counter. And
exactly.
Yeah. We'll see where...
So, hey, Jacob, what exactly were you saying about the citizens? Because I think I know, but just to recap, you mean to grab the close citizen and activate first or second? Or
I want to think, okay, so round turn one, I send a Hired Muscle character up, and they stand in that spot where they can Hired Muscle a citizen close to them, whoever that might be. Yeah. So they're kind of just behind halfway line is kind of that spot they end up in, and they have a citizen on them. Second activation, Lockjaw goes, moves up, short movement, grabs the citizen, and then teleports within range 3 that character, so they bring them closer to home. So can sit in, grab a citizen, and be in 3 of that Hired Muscle spot?
Feels like that's really easy. I mean, he can be within range 2 extremely easily, grabbing close citizen. It may take double move, though, to get there. I'm saying he might be range 2 to get the extra power boost, right?
You teleport back and then they're within range 2.
Isn't it on beginning of his activation to get the power from that, right?
Sure, but you just have like an Okoye or a piddly character that's going to run and grab a secure later to go and do that.
Sure, okay. Yeah, I mean, it's very easy for him to be range 2. Even if he like wants to... like grab the thing and then be range 2 of the someone next, like behind him. It's like very, very easy
for him. Yeah, so I can see that he plays into that strategy that way and makes it even safer. Makes it harder to, I don't know, deception. I know, I guess you have to run that deception play before Lockjaw activates, and that still works fine. But yeah, I think that it makes that, does it make it sufficiently better? Or is it good enough, that Hired Muscle play, without him and having different things in there? I don't know.
Yeah, I think it would be more on the NPE side of things, because I don't think we would be arguing that you don't get a chance to like kill the character first. But if that character lives at like 1 health, then like Lockjaw just puts him away, and then they can just run from there, and now they're just corner board. You know,
and there's quite a few ways of moving them. You've got mind gems, you've got web lines, you've got mystiques, deception. You can have someone like double move throw them. There's ways of moving them so they're not within range 3 of where Lockjaw is going to end up, because it takes an action. So he's only got one move to get in within range 3. So it doesn't take much to move them out of that range.
I hear you. I just would add in Rainbow Bridge and Odin's Blessing, and then some send Lockjaw activation. Like even it, like in the unless it's just an absolute worst case scenario, Lockjaw just might be the insurance policy to just end it, you know?
It feels like that's an expensive insurance policy for 3 threat, though. So,
Yeah.
It comes
I haven't put a lot of thought into it, but I'm not really an Asgard player, apparently. ever since the whole Hired Muscle thing, I kind of gave up on caring about them right now, but... I don't know.
Which is a shame. They're a really fun faction, and you shouldn't, if you're listening to this and you're thinking Asgard is all about Hired Muscle, it really isn't. It's quite a deep and interesting faction, and you can not play Hired Muscle at all and still have a strong competitive game with them. They are their play style is really I enjoy it a lot, where you just like it's brawly, and you've got good control elements, you've got good attrition elements. No, I really rate Asgard, irrespective of the Hired Muscle play.
Yeah. Mentally, I'm just like, let's see if Hired Muscle gets banned, and then I'll rethink it. I'm having a lot of fun with X-Men, so it's like, whatever.
And tell me, are you abusing Hired Muscle in X-Men? Is that a thing?
Yeah. 4 out of my 5 games, I ran Hired Muscle. I gotta say, too, the one game I didn't bring Hired Muscle, I was confused. So, like, what do I do? I literally had to like stop and think, what do I do with my fifth tactics card? I never really conceived this would actually happen. So I think I ended up just taking first class and just making my first turn a little cheaper.
Yeah,
like, not I guess awful. I'll do this.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't that exciting.
But still, it's kind of like lots of times you'll play R&D round one for one power, so I think it's fine.
Yeah.
So the crap up Lockjaw, like, would you guys say he's going to be game-changing at all, or is he just going to be like another average character that has some cool abilities?
I think I can draw a lot of parallels between the hype that surrounded Lockjaw and the hype that surrounded Wong, and how often do you see Wong? So I think you're going to see Lockjaw more often than you see Wong, but I think there are parallels to be drawn there.
I think it's super unfair, the Wong analogy, because the game changed so much after Wong. Like if Wong existed when in the first two seasons of this game, arguably maybe three, well, yeah, probably three, because really season three didn't have all shenanigans.
He did exist.
No. But like, he was, well, the portal thing ended up not like Valkyrie. Like the portal thing, yeah. So you know what? Forget season three. Season three was still kind of nutty because of Cookie brought out all the portal stuff and it got crazy. But I would have like absolutely died for Wong in season two with Cabal. Like when there was no restriction on cards and I could just play a million heal spells and just tank up on MODOK, I would absolutely. And also keep in mind the tactic card or the objective card choices were much smaller back then.
Yeah.
It was like 75% of your games were on Gamma. Like, it was just like, Wong would have been amazing back then. And I think a lot, it's a typical trap we fall into where we analyze characters based on a meta of the past. And then things shift, balance changes, the focus changes, turn one has become absurd. And like, I just feel like Wong has just not really been able to keep up with that. But he would have been like absolutely in love with Cabal, like back in the day, so it is what it is,
When we had Wong's card and people looking at it, like, this is the best two threat in the game, everyone's, it's going to be an auto include in every roster. And I feel like we've got a similar sort of attitude around Lockjaw at the minute. And I think people are going to try it and go, okay, this works really well here, here, and here, but actually, I don't want it in any of these places. So if you are feeling really pumped about the doggo, great. I think it's a fun model. It's got good abilities, but I don't think it's ubiquitous.
Yeah, it's not like a play it in every list situation. Yeah. I mean, think about it too. Like back in the Wong days, everyone was obsessed with Thor. And like, where the hell is Thor these days? Like, Thor feels like an accessory now. Where like, I remember everyone thought Thor was like the greatest thing in the universe. And Thor was played in like 70% of teams or whatever.
Yeah, I mean he's in a third of the top 36. So he's not disappeared, but he's dropped back a couple of spots.
Yeah, it's just we don't talk about Thor like we used to. Is all I'm saying. And it's just different. I think Wong gets a bad rap too. I've actually. When I played Wong in the draft league, I actually did well. I went 3-0, and Wong in Avengers was cute. I mean, it's still just a draft league at the end of the day. And Wong's, he plays with Strange fine. It's just, I don't know. I mean, like, Defenders evolve differently, and Wong's a member of the Defender. So it's not like, I feel like blaming Wong to just be a bad character is, like, unjust.
I'm not saying Wong's my character. Absolutely, but what I'm saying is, people were like, "Oh, this guy's amazing!" when he first got spoiled, yeah. Hit the table, and you just don't see him anymore.
I mean, another example is Ebony Maw.
Yeah, I remember being really high on Ebony Maw when he first came out.
The game, everybody was the whole entire game blew up when Ebony's card was leaked. Everybody's like, "This guy's gonna break this game," and
yeah.
Like what is he at for people taking him right now? Like one person?
Proxima was accused to also be horrible power creep. I mean, there's all kinds of examples of goofy judgments.
Yeah. So, yeah. That was our longest hot take ever.
I think he deserved it, though. Lockjaw's crazy. Like, just, and I don't mean like the character in the game. I mean the amount of discussion that's been around him.
Yeah, I think the character's fine to good. There we go. Fine to good.
I was going to say that I think that he's in that line exactly of the fine to decent. Like, he's nothing spectacular. I don't think he's anything crazy, but he's not bad at all. I think he's going to have a nice little spot in the sun for a minute, and then he'll just become middle of the road taken.
Yeah. It's fair to say, too, though, that I could see games where he would be frustrating if someone's kind of running away with the game and then he's just, like, moving characters. This is something I've said publicly randomly on our Discord, but I think AMG needs to seriously consider some kind of just passive idea that moving characters beyond range 2 with objective tokens should probably be avoided at all costs. It's just, in my opinion, Rainbow Bridge and, I don't know, maybe Gamma Leap and then the Defender's Portal. Those cards should say, if carrying an extract cannot use this card.
I mean, like, the X-Men Gamma Leadership. Lord does.
What's that?
Gamma Launch does.
Gamma Launch is, yeah. Yeah, I always get the names mixed up.
But, I mean, at least they made it cost an action. Could you imagine if that ability didn't cost an action?
Oh, it would be insane. That would probably be broken. I mean, the fact it costs an action... Yeah.
Unless that's like power cost was prohibitive, like 4 or 5, then maybe I'd be fine with that.
Sure. Very expensive.
If he spent all his power going, I'm a good doggo, here's all my power to teleport and then I move twice. Maybe even then it wouldn't be balanced. But I have you may class this as naivety, but I have a decent amount of faith in the playtesting abilities of AMG. I think that generally they've been shown to have done a good job in producing characters that are broadly within a very narrow power band. And there's not very many that they've missed the mark, and there's not very many that they've overshot the mark in terms of the power level. And a lot of them were quite early when they were maybe learning their own game a bit more.
Yeah, well, let me say this, because I sort of assume sometimes that people just know I'm thinking something, and then I realize, oh, I haven't actually talked to this audience about this. But the characters we're playing with now were probably developed like around like 12 months or more ago. So like when we're complaining about like drop-off and special delivery, I mean... those cards were made so long ago. So it's not like, oh, we made like a restricted list and then like we still went ahead and designed special delivery. Like, no, special delivery was made at least like 12 months ago. At least. I've heard rumors of like 18 months. So like when I say like they need to like start focusing and restricting these movement cards, I'm fully understanding that potentially for another year, we're going to get more of these cards. But like even if they like decided today to like actually do this, or maybe they already decided, let's say a week ago they just decided, Sploosh is right, we should be more careful with movement stuff, we're not even going to reap the benefits of that decision for another at least year. So yes. I'm respectful of that, and I understand that I have been just a tiny bit a playtester, and I know it's not fair to just like rag on playtesters. It's not at all fair because things aren't released at the same time. You know, like Hired Muscle may not have been tested and released when Angela was created, or, you know, maybe when they tested Angela, they didn't have Rainbow Bridge yet. Like Rainbow Bridge might have been a late add. Angela was on one of the very early affiliation cards. She might have been designed in like February. But then in like end of summer or whatever, they had created Rainbow Bridge. Like, there's so many variables that you can't, and I'm definitely not trying to put any blame. And I think the balance of this game is easily one of the most balanced games I've ever played.
I agree.
But if I had a nitpick, it would just be that please, please, please be careful when you just let characters get moved around. It's just, you know, I think Asteroid M and Mothership are the pinnacle of example of how to treat this. And I think they need to, like, just do that from now on, please. I'm begging you.
Is this a new segment of Spoosh's Rant of the Week?
Maybe. Yeah, sorry, that's a little tangent, but it's been on my
mind. Oh, no, it's fine.
Hot topic. I mean, you know.
I think it's a valid point. But... I think he made a good point. That's all I have to say about that.
Yeah, and like, there's precedent for it too. Like Astrid M and Mothership. They say if you're holding the objective, you cannot teleport. Okay.
Or X-Men Leadership, you can't hold the objective to get the free glob.
Thank you. And it took me a while to learn that. Like, I played a lot of X-Men, and at first I would screw up, and I catch myself sometimes, like, oh, hold on, I can't do that. Why am I spending like 2 minutes thinking of this cool play that isn't legal?
Yeah.
I did that 2 games ago. I was like, had this idea in my head that I'd do a flip into a throw with Storm, and then realized that all those cool ideas were invalid. So, you know, just apologized to my opponent and explained why I was wasting time. But anyway, yeah.
Well, we've gone kind of similar to our normal length, so I'm wondering, guys, if we just dive into one of our listener questions, which came out a couple of days ago. I think this is a good question, actually. So this is from Dave Rain 89. Thanks for listening to the podcast, Dave, and thanks for joining the Discord. If any of you out there want to join the Discord, find a link in the show notes and come along. We would love to have you there and join in the conversation. Dave's question is, how would people feel about having repeated leaderships? Example, the new Falcon cap could have the word-for-word day, unlike any other leadership on Corset cap.
You want to start, Desert?
Yeah, so I've been thinking about this because I kind of really wanted to hit on this question specifically. And I think that eventually there's this thing within game development called design space, and you only have a limited amount of it to where it becomes stagnant or similar or stuff like that. So I think it'd be completely fine because, like, this is what this leadership does for this affiliation. And I think it's okay, because, again, it comes back to that you only have so much design space within a game, and I think that's the big thing. I would like to see more leadership affiliations because it's really cool, but if you start spreading it out really thin like that, you're just going to run out of ideas. It's just inevitable.
Yeah, I think I kind of take the opposite point of view for the same reason, in a kind of a weird way. what I mean is, I think I would be fine with, like, Falcon Cap getting the Wakanda leadership, let's say, the pay one to reroll one. Nothing about that screams Wakanda to me. It doesn't, you know, it ties in nicely with kind of their mechanics and kind of their sort of build ideology. They've got every character in Wakanda has rerolls, great. Apart from Storm, weirdly. But I don't see why that leadership doesn't scream Wakanda to me. Some of them are, like, more closely linked. I think Black Order getting a VP for a KO, that's really strongly linked to what they do. But taking someone else's leadership and applying it to a different affiliation, I think that opens up interesting design space. And I think if you have two characters, because the leadership is such a big part of why you're playing that affiliation, if you had the same leadership as Cap, and it's a great leadership, but I think most people think that Cap is a little bit underwhelming for a four-threat character outside of his leadership, which is why you never see him taken out of affiliation, kind of similar to Red Skull. And maybe it's, you're more likely to take one than the other, but neither of them really are taken outside of affiliation at all. So what you've got is a character who is part of, so much of their cost is wrapped up in their leadership. So either Falcon would have to be equally underwhelming or equally whelming as Cap in terms of his inability to be taken out of affiliation in order to offset that price he's paying for that good affiliation. ability. Whereas give him, I don't know, Cyclops's affiliation, Cyclops leadership, which is, you know, widely regarded to be one of the worst. And then say, right, well, now we can have just a standard four threat character. And yeah, you've got a leadership. You're not getting as much value out of it, but you've got a leadership and you're still in Avengers. So you can play all of those cool characters and you can play those Avengers tactics cards. Like Anger Management, turns out that's an Avengers tactics card. so you can play all of those cool stuff that you want to play with, but you've got a decent character, but you're not getting as much value out of the leadership as you would with Cap. And maybe that's
I think that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Are we strictly talking about taking, for example, Cap's leadership in other affiliations, or are we can we talk about just multiple leaders within the same affiliation, potentially with the same leadership?
Yeah, so...
Are we talking, though, the same or different?
Well, the question was the same. How would you feel if Sin had the exact same leadership as Red Skull, for example? Because we know she's the second Cabal leader.
So maybe I'm biased. I feel like I'm becoming the old school of the game because I remember like loving, you know, playing Red Skull. I think personally that Red Skull and Cap are slightly under par, and I mean they're core set characters. They're for early design, blah blah blah. Like I don't want to argue the balance or power of them, but. Then it opens up this idea of like, well, let's say Sin did have Red Skull's exact leadership. I think there'd be arguments about power creep, but I just don't know. Is that okay? Like for the game, I think it'd be better for the game to do it because otherwise, like you're going to see Cabal just not be popular. And then it's like, well, what's the count? What do you do? If you, let's just say there's some rule where you could never remake Red Skull with the same affiliation, then you could argue, well, just make Cabal members more powerful to compensate. But like, that's not good because you could take these characters unaffiliated and it kind of makes the balance weird in other directions. So, you know, I'm not a game designer, but like I personally as a player would be fine with like them actually just reprinting Cap and Red Skull like and be better. I think if you gave them the same leadership, then people would get mad that it's just like a pure power creep. And maybe I'm just opening up a whole other conversation, but the bottom line is I would like to see Cabal and Avengers played like, I guess, competitively, and they have a huge roster and they're very popular. So you should want that to be a thing where they're better. So I don't know, man. I don't know how you do it. Like, do you just not make another Red Skull and Cap and then copy the leadership? For example, Iron Man being the leader of the Avengers. Would it be okay with you guys to have Iron Man with the exact same leadership of Cap and be more balanced?
My issue there is you're then obsoleting Cap. I think Cap is such a fan favorite as well that it would be really sad to get to a position where everyone's like, man, why would you ever play Captain America? Now, at the minute, I can make a compelling argument. I want to play Avengers. I want to get this great leadership. I want to get Loki trickstering away for one less. I want to get all of these cool things that it can do. And saying, well, I can get all that same stuff and I can get a character who performs on the table outside of the leadership better than Cap for maybe the same cost, maybe cheaper, who knows. Cap's just going to see zero table time. So I think that would be a backward step rather than a forward step.
So if we don't want to argue, we're just going to agree for science that Cap is an inferior mini, then are we just... I'm not saying he, like, maybe he isn't, but let's just pretend he is.
So much of his value.
Do you want another Cap?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do we want another Cap created at some point with the exact same leadership?
No. No, I don't. Because then you just go, this Captain America model goes in the bin and never gets played. And this card gets broken up. And I don't think that's a good
thing. That's so tricky.
I think it'd be a Cap with either a different leadership ability or Cap isn't a leader.
Well, it's hard to picture Cap as not a leader, but I don't know. They could probably rip something out of somewhere.
Wasn't he U.S. agent for a while when he?
No, they're different people.
The same person. It's a different character name. but it's the same alter ego.
Is it the same person, but he's different reality or something?
No, there's this one bit where Cap is like, I want to do things which Captain America wouldn't do, so I'm not going to stop being Captain America for a while and do the things that Captain America wouldn't agree to doing.
Blizzard, help me. Is this true? Because I'm pretty sure they're different people.
I thought it was the same person.
They have like a completely different personality. I'm not an expert, but I actually looked this up recently because I saw a U.S. agent in Marvel Champions, and I was like, who the hell is this guy? My understanding is his personality. Basically, the writers wanted to write a Cap, but him have a different personality. And actually, like I think he like drinks, and he's like more like, I don't know. He's less heroic. I don't know.
He's less Cap.
He's much less Cap. Like he's more like grumpy or like.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I thought it was the same dude from what I remember, but I didn't. I don't know for sure. Somebody wants to comment on that and give us the answer. We have a Discord.
Come on Discord and tell us how little we know about comics.
No, maybe we should open up another channel that's just a lore section for the channel. We'll talk
fine.
Lore.
We'll find them.
Yeah, that's fine.
In the general chat, and we will talk about it there. I don't think that's a problem.
All right.
Yeah, I guess a different Cap with a different leadership would be the excuse to have two Caps. It's a shame because then it. I don't know. I mean, the developers have done really well. I don't think we need duplicates. Then, I think you guys have kind of convinced me to lean in the like no duplicates. Zone. I really like the idea that affiliations are unique by their leadership, and I don't want that to go away.
Yeah,
but there's so much to an affiliation beyond the leadership, though. So I think it's fine to double up on leadership, and they haven't done that yet. And I think they might have been criticized if they had doubled up on leadership already. But I think a second leader who's got the same leadership as a different affiliation, I'm not sure, is a problem. And from what this has said about design space, there is a limited design space. And for sure, you can come up with all sorts of cool and weird and wonderful leaderships. But I think some of the kind of the easy, obvious beats have been hit. And I don't see that repeating them is necessarily a problem.
Yeah. So I, like I said, like when it first started, I was kind of on the other boat, similar, same, whatever. but I think I agree with that the most is I think... if they do have repeats, it should be over to a different affiliation. Because then that could just completely unlock a whole entire different side of that affiliation. Like, what if Cabal had Cap's leadership? Like, flip side of the coin. You know what I mean?
Yeah, kind of like an Axis thing going on there. Yeah, how's that for your comic knowledge?
I don't know. I don't think I'd like that.
Or let's give Cabal weaning it, you know? Give Cabal Guardians.
No!
Let's give everyone A-Force, because that's a really good leadership.
Yeah.
No. You guys are crazy. No, I think it feels like, I don't know, like it feels Avengers. Like they've brainwashed me, I suppose. I feel like, getting cheaper powers, that's an Avengers thing. Like it just, I associate now. So.
But that's because that's the best thing about the affiliation, because the leaders... kind of fine. It's not like a leader you're really pleased about taking, like Black Panther, or you know, I guess Thor. It's the tactics cards again are kind of like Avengers Assemble. That's good. It's got some nice play, but often it feels like, I guess I'll take it. Second Wind doesn't see much play. Anger Management, man. Have you ever seen that played? Ever? I think I've played it once in like the first month of the game. Went, man, this didn't do what I wanted it to do. So yeah, the tactics cards aren't the best. They've got a huge affiliation list, I guess that's good, but when you're looking at like the best characters in the game, how many of them are Avengers? Like Black Panther, maybe Vision.
I think to conclude this a little is I think the developers have showed us how they feel based on the way they did X-Men and Brotherhood. Yeah. And I would suspect, based on how they've done it so far, they will continue that path. So, yeah. And it's a cute way to make the team your own, right? Like, so for example, like under Storm's leadership, X-Men play like this, obviously, right? I think Mystique and Magneto are a great example, really. It's just like, one is like cause mayhem, break things. The other one is mayhem, but like controlling these points and terrorizing... object, you know, because she's like a sneaky bomber, terrorist kind of personality. So, you know, insurgent, if you will.
Favoring more the attrition game, and one's kind of playing towards the scenario game. So it's nice that you've got different ways you can play the same affiliation.
Yeah, same affiliation, two completely different styles. I mean, it feels like, you know, a card game or whatever, you know, different personalities that can come out of the same characters. I think that's pretty neat. So I agree with the way they're doing it. That being said, Cyclops is not maybe seeing much play, and I think Mystique hasn't really shown us much yet with the way she plays. Maybe in the future, though, that will change, so we'll have to see. Unfortunately, you know what I'm saying? Like, somebody has to come and rise to the top, you know? I mean, we're competitive players. I mean, casually, that doesn't matter, right?
Yeah, sure. Even so, the gap between the top of the crop and the bottom of the crop is, like you say, is one of the narrowest of any games I've played as well. So I think the developers have by and large done a really good job.
100%.
Well, that wraps it up for this episode of The Danger Room. We hope you enjoyed it and learned something to level up your next game. You can reach out to us on our Discord, Twitter, or Facebook. The links will be in the description. We have a questions channel on our Discord, so feel free to drop us some questions in there and we'll answer them on the show. Thank you for taking the time and listening to us. If you're liking what you hear, leave a rating or comment, or even both. We appreciate any feedback to help us grow and become a better group to bring you the best quality content that we can. See you next time in the Danger Room.